Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Visit audiblepodcast.com/auctionpodcast for your free audiobook download.
Hi, this is Martin Willis.
And Phyllis Gow.
The Antique Auction Podcast Show. And we're here today at the studio of a well-known photorealistic painter. We're going to be talking with him, an interview with him. It's Richard McLean. And hello, Richard. How are you?
Well, just fine, Martin.
So, Richard, this movement that you were involved in became quite a segment of art that's still very strong today. But can you tell us all the way back to the beginning of how you got into art and what, you know, when you decided to make that your career and pursue it?
Well, the question is how far back do you really want to go? I've been drawing and modeling with clay when I was a child. And my foster parents always made sure that I had plenty of those materials around. And it was a great rainy day preoccupation in the Northwest where I grew up. So I think there's some truth to the idea that you wind up becoming that thing for which you get the most praise. As a child. I remember getting rather mediocre, if not downright negative, reports when I was in the second, third grades. I had a habit of drawing around the borders of spelling papers and whatnot. So I always got positive reports from my teacher about my visual abilities and visual skills.
You bombed on this test, but the drawing was next.
The drawing.
A on the drawing.
A on the drawing.
D on the spelling.
D on the spelling. So that happened all the way through. I was later on in high school. I was given special time off from duties at home, as long as I had a drawing. If I was busy drawing, my siblings would then be assigned my chores.
I bet they hated that.
I've been at it for as long as I can remember. And there were books in the house. It wasn't what you would call an artistic environment that I grew up in.
What did your parents do?
Well, my parents, my foster mother was a practical nurse at the county hospital in Longview, Washington, I believe. And my foster father worked for Weyerhaeuser as a, I think he built train trestles to haul logs out of the forest and Olympic Peninsula. So he was in the logging business. After having spent a life on a ranch as a young person in South Dakota. So they were basically rural people and knew nothing about art particularly. But
it's amazing that they would encourage that in you.
Yeah, the fact that I could draw, it may be somewhat of a phenomenon in the family. I mean, I have an aunt, very ancient by now, mm-hmm. who is reported to still have some little plasticine clay figures that I had molded when I was 5, 6, 7 years old
wow.
in a shoebox in her ice box. And she's kept them all these years.
Oh.
So I remember an uncle served in the Philippines, World War II, so he was quite a young guy, the youngest of that family. And he played violin, was studying music at the university in Seattle. Mm. So he was quite highly thought of in the family for that reason, too. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there was no one else in the family that exhibited any creative abilities, particularly.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a time in your life, though, that there was a turn where you said, okay, I want to be an artist, I want to be a professional artist?
Well, sometime during high school, I remember my English teacher had me illustrate a book that she had written. She was an author of what they call books for young people. And it was The Life of Chief Joseph, the Nez Perce tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And this was up in north central Idaho, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Small logging and ranching community of about 500 people in the town. She had me ask me if I would like to illustrate the book, and there were promises of at least some fortune, if not fame, from Little and Brown publishers in New York, who were going to produce the book. And so I spent a summer, I remember, researching the Nez Perce tribe to get all of the details and the costuming and the way they dressed.
You took it serious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I remember 14 full-page pen and ink illustrations of various parts of the book that provided something visually interesting to work from. Excuse me. Curiously enough, nothing came of that. The book never got published.
Oh.
And I never got my drawings back.
Oh, no. Oh, I was just about to ask you.
Yeah. But I went ahead and graduated high school, and I was also very interested in jazz at the time, and still am. I played trumpet and sort of led the pet band for the school, and I also played for dances on Saturday nights, at, both in town and in surrounding communities.
Oh, that's very cool.
They actually paid you. I think I made $12 per night or something like that.
Hey.
And so I fancied myself a kind of... Bunny Berrigan or Harry James. Turns out I wasn't anywhere near that good, but neither my audience nor I could tell the difference too much, I think, in those days. But I had a decision to make. Around my senior year, and I was whether to go into art, because I know I could do that. Going into music, I was having difficulty reading music. So that's a major hindrance there in my career. And I wisely chose the visual arts. With the idea of going into illustration.
Really?
And becoming a commercial artist, a commercial illustrator.
Oh, wow.
because artists at the time that I admired were like people like Stephen DeHonos and Howard Pyle and N.C. Wyeth and Norman Rockwell.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Love N.C. Wyeth. Yeah.
So I would take myself off to Chicago Art Institute and learn how to be an illustrator.
Right.
My high school teacher, one of my teachers, we remember having a discussion with him, my mother and myself, discussing what the next move should be, and he suggested again wisely that I get a couple of years of liberal arts education first and then make a decision about specializing in a profession. Concentration.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down to Boise Junior College and enrolled and did 2 years there, graduated out of there. And during that time, I first came into contact with some formal instruction in art. Never had any formal instruction up to that time.
I see.
In high school, I was the one-man art department. I illustrated the yearbooks.
Oh, wow. Do you still have those?
I still have a couple of those yearbooks, 52 and 53, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the students at the college who graduated a year or so before me, he had gone down to Oakland. I think he settled in on the peninsula somewhere, San Mateo or somewhere. But he would have had a long haul to make. But anyway, he graduated or was in the process of finishing school at the College of Arts and Crafts in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And came back one semester and addressed the art class that I was in at junior college in Boise. Mm-hmm. It's his hometown. And reported having a great time down there and learning an awful lot. And he really kind of sold me on the idea of maybe going to California and staying, on the West Coast, basically, rather than go back to Chicago. Mm-hmm. Plus, I had an uncle, the violin player, my uncle, who he and his wife were living in Palo Alto. So that would have given us some kind of a social base that we could tie into. And so I decided to go to art school. The idea of still pursuing training in commercial art.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw, I guess it was maybe... I started out as a low sophomore. I lost a semester lacking art credits enough from a junior college.
Mm-hmm.
So that I had an extra semester to make up. So about 2.5 years to graduate out of College of Arts and Crafts.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, I was fortunate enough to study with Richard Diebenkorn for a couple of semesters.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been something.
Yeah, it was really quite an epiphany for me because I was overwhelmed. I mean, coming down to California to such a den of activity, arts and crafts was a cauldron of creative energy.
Right, and the whole era. So that was about 1960?
Before 60, it was 1955.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We got married, and by the end of summer, we were bunked in down here in Oakland.
Yeah.
And my wife got a job. The understanding, of course, is that she would work, and you know, put me through school, and then
Nice.
If she wanted to continue school, I'd, of course, I'd be handsomely paid for whatever I was doing.
And, that's a good plan.
Yeah, didn't turn out to quite like that. But then she would be able to pursue studies if she wished to. So, anyway, with all of this stuff hitting me from all sides and getting a whole new notion of what art could look like, what it could be, there was an exhibition held of Richard D. McGuire's work on campus. In what was then called Guild Auditorium, which was a stage, a little theater area, you know, so it's the largest floor space on the campus. And he just had all three walls lined with his work from the Berkeley series, the landscape abstractions. And I can't tell you what a shock that was. I mean, what an eye-opener. And I became an instant devotee of not only his style, but abstract painting. And totally jettisoned the idea of illustration and, you know, painting or drawing things that look like something.
Well, I have to say, looking at your 1960s abstract work, it's very, very good. I really think you had something there if you pursued that.
Well, it was in the library on campus. We used to, they subscribed to a number of art magazines. And so Art News, Ms. Thomas Hess was the editor then, and Art News was a great source of information, and I would see illustrations in there on Willem de Kooning's work, the Abstract Expressionists in New York, so I knew that whole thing was going on back there. And then in Demonkorn, we had a kind of West Coast version of those same impulses. And, of course, I was right next door to Demonkorn. So he was an immediate influence, a very real influence in that sense. I was getting an influence from the Abstract Expressionists in general and de Kooning in particular. He was my favorite. Through print media. So that really made a painter out of me, basically. I mean, Demonkorn was not a loquacious teacher. I mean, he didn't have a lot to say. He said a couple of cryptic things to me, which I think meant quite a bit after I got to thinking about them. But I wasn't somebody he lingered long over, but he didn't flunk me out of the class either, though. When I saw those paintings of his, it just, I knew exactly what he was trying to get at. And all the utterances that I read of his on the subject of painting always made perfect sense to me. It's exactly the way I understood his work to be, you know, his whole insistence upon getting it right. It's a very famous quote of his. And it's just, it was just a mainline path to the truth of painting as it was understood in those days for me. And, and so he taught me in a very indirect way. It wasn't anything that he said to me that was particularly profound, but just looking at his work, it just was took you into another world. So that really settled it for me. I went up the administration building and changed my my major to fine arts, because I was also aware that D. McCorn was, I think he was just making a connection with Poindexter in New York. So I knew that he was, that he was able to sell and able to gain some degree of recognition. Of course, nothing like what later developed. He was just kind of getting, his career was just beginning to take off at that time, in the mid-50s. And but he was teaching to make ends meet, and of course that's what all the artists did in the Bay Area. I wound up following the same pattern. Fortunately, there were schools in the area, universities, private institutions, state colleges, whatnot, all with growing faculties, and tended to absorb the better talent available in the area, and you could get a teaching job, so you could teach and still have enough time to get your painting done. If you didn't teach high school or grade school, then you're dodging erasers and breaking up fist fights. I don't know what else. But the kind of teaching that gave me the most time to log in the studio would be teaching on the college level. So, and you also didn't need a teaching credential.
Is that right?
You basically needed the admiration and the respect of your peers who were already teaching. And if you could gain that, then you would get yourself into a teaching job. And that's the way it happened. So that looked like the perfect way to go. And that's the way I've been pursuing it ever since.
Now, when did you move from, say, the abstraction? What steered you toward the photorealism that you're so
well
known for?
Well, I painted, tried to emulate, let's face it, D. McCorn's style. I mean, I was just so totally enthralled with his style. To me, I'd look at one of his paintings and I'd say, that's what painting's about. I mean, I can't see it looking any other way.
How closely did you work with him? I mean,
I had a beginning painting class, I believe, when I first got there, and then I had more of a senior class by the time I was at the end of my 2 years or so, and.
So he was well aware of the influence he was having on
him. Yeah, and in those days, that curious phenomenon that we all enjoyed during the 50s and the early 60s were the competitive annuals that the museums show through. Every year. I mean, they had juried exhibitions. San Francisco Art Institute, the Museum of Modern Art, or San Francisco Oakland Museum, Richmond Art Center. And they would have at least one or two, or sometimes three. I think Richmond Art Center had a painting annual, and then they later on had a sculpture and printmaking annual at the same time. Sort of graphics and sculpture, and with painting itself for separate annual. Jurors would be hired to come out, sometimes from quite a ways out of town, I mean, maybe back east. Or, of course, there were visiting artists out of the university and whatnot, and they would be could be tapped for that purpose. And what it did is it, since there was almost no art scene that supported a gallery situation here in the Bay Area at that time.
Maybe really?
You had, what, two or three galleries? You had the Sixth Gallery in San Francisco. You had Rose Rabeau Gallery. They have very small stables. Mm. And for up-and-coming and ambitious, hungry young Turks like myself, there just wasn't any way to show. And of course, the students were quite precocious. I mean, the understanding was that students were not allowed to enter competitive exhibitions.
Is that right?
They were for the professional painting community. But, you know, that line would become very blurred. The Jack London Square Art Show, too. It was an outdoor show at the one up in North Beach. I mean, there were just various venues that they'd sort of get mixed together. I remember being in a show in Richmond.
When you were still a student?
I think Wayne Thiebaud was rejected by the jury, and
is
I was
that
accepted.
Right?
I mean, curious things like that.
Yeah,
of course.
That's like what happened to the Beatles, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
The Beatles were rejected, yeah.
Huh.
You didn't know that? Yeah. That's another segment.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so you know Wayne Thiebaud as well?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But I was introduced to Wayne, I think, back in about 1960. I just started at Mills College after putting 2 years in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Okinawa for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And came back out and immediately enrolled to do my master's work at Mills.
Mm-hmm.
I was taken on as a teaching assistant by Bob Arneson at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we became quite close. We were good friends. But at that time, I was just working with him as a teaching assistant. And I remember we went over to the Young Museum right when Wayne was having his first big museum show there at the De Young. And he was inside the room, and he had paintings lined up all around the corners of the walls, figuring out which ones he was going to place and whatnot. So it was a little three-person visit there.
What was he painting at that time?
Oh, he was doing the, the food.
Back then?
Pieces. Oh, yeah.
Because I have seen earlier landscapes and things.
Yeah, well, some of those may have been mixed in, actually, because I remember, as I say, I could remember that 58 and 59 were spent in the military, so I wasn't on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
I was buying Time magazine in Okinawa and then tearing the pages out of Time magazine. And they did an article on de Kooning in the art section. I pinned it up on the wall of my little studio in a village that I was renting a room in, using as a studio.
So you met with Wayne.
Yeah, I'm losing my my train of thought here. in 60, he was doing some of the food things, because I remember he was a hot dog painting was in the Richmond Art Center 1 year. I think it actually got on the wall. I mean, he was a bit controversial with those things in the early years, around here anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Diebenkorn could paint, a halved tomato with a paring knife next to it, with, of course, all of his luscious, not to say that Wayne didn't paint just as lusciously, but I think it was the subject matter was a problem with Wayne as far as the what criticism that he got from local artists in the area here. Bechtel ran into that same situation with his very cool, banal kind of approach to imagery, too, later on.
Mm-hmm.
But hot dogs, my God, or a hamburger sandwich. Of course, the animosity between, or the antipathies between fine art, high art, and popular culture has always been very strong in the area. Mm-hmm. And Wayne was just breaking through that. He was a transitional figure there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was our first bit of the experience with pop art, or what even, you know, they were, mm-hmm. he was lumped together with pop artists in those
mm-hmm.
days.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 60s, that's when I, to answer your question, I knew I couldn't go on painting second, third rate demon corns. All my life. It just it was a dead end. I mean, he said it all. I mean, that was it. He owned that territory.
Mm-hmm.
It belonged to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I was beginning to pick up on stuff that was happening not only here locally. Things were beginning to foment and change a bit. Things certainly back in New York were. We're in L.A. L.A. was pretty hot at that time in terms of, they never shared our figurative action painting approach to art in Northern, that we have going in Northern California.
Yeah.
I don't remember really vividly in any way what it was that made me change, although I knew that I couldn't go on. I began to be very nervous and very anxious about painting the way I was producing some nice paintings, but mm-hmm. I wasn't satisfied with them. I threw mm-hmm. a lot of paintings away in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And I just trashed them because mm-hmm. they I saw too much. I remember back in 60s, mid-60s somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe 63, 64, somewhere there. Bob Arneson and his wife were over for dinner. When I took him downstairs in his house we rented in Oakland and showed him what I was working on, this little basement grotto that I had fashioned into a studio. And I had a couple of three paintings around that I had finished.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, he started looking at them and he says, geez, he says, I see a little Jasper Johns here and I see some de Kooning over here. And I see some Rauschenberg here.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see you in any of these.
Mm. Wow.
No.
Mm. Mm.
Did you destroy those paintings?
Well, actually, it's really high. I think about it once in a while because I remember it, and I have slide records of all those pictures.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what happened to some of them. Some of my trash, some of them would get I'd give to auctions or something, or benefit mm-hmm. a benefit auction or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of got under my skin.
Yeah,
and, Bob was always a bit of a chiding friend that way. I mean, he was sort of my conscience in that sense. Mm. I mean, he was always a goad to moving me ahead to something more authentic to my own experience and not,
mm-hmm.
You know, so I was basically just trading demon corn for Rauschenberg, Johns, and whoever else.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So, I don't know. The 60s, proceeded to be a very tumultuous decade for me.
Okay.
I mean, I moved basically from total devotion to a Diebenkorn-esque approach to painting, and wound up working for the photograph in a very meticulous realism by 1970.
I was thoroughly
committed.
Huh. If you could, I don't. It's probably a very difficult thing to do, but I mean, the philosophy that you adapted from Diebenkorn. How would you be able to explain that in a few minutes? And how? And the reason why I ask that is, how is it? You know, how did that translate to this new style of painting that you adapted that was completely different?
Excuse me. Say it again.
How did you take that philosophy and apply it to? I mean, how did that reconcile with this transformation into photorealism? That philosophy.
Well, it's if you take the process that I use, point for point.
Can you explain exactly what that is, real quickly?
Yeah. Diebenkorn would take a blank canvas. And when I say this, it wasn't, I mean, he had this peculiar approach, I mean, all action painters, all abstract expressionists, if you will, tended to take the approach of starting out with a blank canvas. Mm-hmm. With no particular preset idea as to what you were going to do. You would let the painting develop and begin to find its own direction. And it was an exciting way to paint.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, you just start throwing some paint on and you start smearing something. In the early stage, it didn't really quite matter what you did. You just... the idea was to get some activity going, to get some counterplay between various elements, and then hoping that at some point something starts to click, and you begin to recognize a direction or a drift or something, and you pursue that event, and then finally it gets somehow something gets clarified as you... as you move through it. My approach, as it has been for the last, almost 40 years, has been to start out with an idea that is preset.
Sure.
It's already figured out right down to the last detail before any paint even hits the canvas. It's all planned and plotted out. I can do that through it's what I do with the photograph before it becomes a painting. Analyzing the photograph. There's an awful lot of thought and analysis that goes in to the photo image before you actually commit it to paint. Then, so with some justification, people will ask, "Well, then, what's the point in painting it? I mean, you got it all figured out. You know, you hold it up and you say, 'Okay, that's what it's going to look like, this 35 millimeter slide,' and then you." Turn around, you tell me that you spent 4 months proving that the slide was right. Well, of course, it's more complicated than that. But it is a total turnabout the way Diebenkorn approached it.
Now there was there was you along with Bechtel and Close and all these other names. You all were part of this movement of photorealism. Did you paint together, or did you share ideas, or what created that whole movement?
Well, after a few exhibitions and a couple of important ones in New York, the critics began to recognize this as a deadly virus at large in the art world.
Quote, unquote.
Yeah. Yeah, you might say. And they began to throw rocks at it from every angle. I mean, I, for one, couldn't understand what the brouhaha was about, because it just seemed a natural transition. I'd spent 10 years working my way through this thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So by the time, you know, I get the painting and I hold it up and I say, what do you think of this? And I get a pie in the face, you know. I mean, that's what happened to everybody who was working like this. I mean, there were fierce champions who defended the style and said, this is something new, something different, just come along. And but the art critical community just insisted on vociferously demonizing
mm-hmm.
this, what they perceived as a unholy cabal or an alliance between fame-seeking, money-hungry artists, opportunists.
Mm-hmm.
And again, opportunistic, money-grubbing dealers.
Mm-hmm. I saw some of the quotes and for the critics that they were saying, something along the lines where, what's the difference between doing that and taking a photograph?
Yeah.
Or, you know, if you want a large photograph, just make a large photograph. Or,
yeah.
You know, all that. And but controversy always spawns a movement, and it always spawns collectability, you know, when there's controversy in art. I mean, it always seems to.
Yeah. Well, that's what kind of surprised me. I thought, how many times do we have to go through this before critics understand that they're just following in the footsteps of every contrarian critic that...
from the beginning of time.
Yeah, so, yeah, they've always knocked the new.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they should know by now that, of course, now I take a different view about music. But I don't think that just because something is new that hasn't been seen before is necessarily good or it's better than what it's replacing.
Mm-hmm.
But it is inevitable.
Mm-hmm. Sure, changes.
Once that door gets open, there's mm-hmm. nothing you can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can like it or not like it, or agree with it or not agree with it, but it's going to happen. It's going to be there
mm-hmm.
anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I referred to it, for instance, to borrow from Oscar Wilde, the painting style that dare not speak its name.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, on one level, I can understand why the controversy existed. But I could never sympathize with it.
I have a technical question. Mm-hmm. Do you stage your photographs before you take them? Do you figure...
Stage them?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a... What I had to do to get a photograph... That's why I'm still going back through some of my slide files for future works without going out and trying to get new ones.
Mm-hmm.
There's a number of reasons why I'm not doing new ones. But I'm not physically as able to operate the way I used to.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go, in the first place, I start off... partly because it was a kind of perverse thing to do, or to take a photograph, especially one that didn't belong to you. It was out of a book. It could be out of a magazine, a newspaper.
Yeah.
I remember doing a series of things that I took from Encyclopedia Britannica,
hmm.
black and white half-tone reproductions.
Hmm.
Okay. I saw someone did one of Kennedy out of a magazine.
Yeah.
Photoreal. I can't remember who it was. Ann, maybe? Ann, one of the photorealist painters.
That did Kennedy?
Yeah, it was Kennedy. In
assassination genre.
Not assassination, but Kennedy in a convertible.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with Jackie, yeah.
Oh, well, that was during the Dallas thing, as I remember, yeah.
Yeah.
That could be any number of people. I mean, it's a very, you know, as themes go, or subjects, that it's a popular subject. Mm-hmm. It could have been done by who's the German?
Oh, this was Gerhard, a woman named Anne, and I just can't remember her last name. Anne or Anna, but...
don't know any photorealist names. Yeah. I don't know if she's local or not, I fell into a... I started working from photographs that were not my own.
Mm-hmm.
Except I must say that the first photograph, the first painting I did back in 66 was of Joan Ely, a colleague of mine at San Francisco State, headed up the printmaking department over there. And he was kind of a weekend cowboy. He had a horse that he kept pastured up a ways from his house in Marin County. And I had been doing a series of animal pictures, and I remember deciding, I'm not going to be painting abstract paintings anymore.
Right.
So, and I do have this ability to draw. I'm a good draftsman. And what am I going to put these skills to? What is it that I want to say? What do I want to portray as a painter? And I was thinking that a territory that had not been explored and was pretty much ignored in this century anyway was animals in general, at least not in the so-called fine art level that I was operating on. The serious painter, as we call them. In the amateur world, there's no end to dog and horse painters. And that, but how could I do this, and how could I give it some kind of contemporary relevance to the painting of my time without making it look like I rehashed Lamsey or Rose Oppenor or something like that. And so it was a kind of quasi-pop impulse that caused me to go foraging around in the Encyclopedia Britannica and take it, because they were not expressive photographs. They were strictly reportage. This is the way a Jersey cow looks.
Right.
You know, and they set the thing up so for the purpose of being in a book of knowledge and information. And there's something kind of distanced about that, kind of removed, that I liked. And in fact, that's one of the basic and ongoing ingredients. You'll also hear Bechtel talk about this too, about that kind of emotional detachment that one needs to effectively explore the painting possibilities of a particular subject. I remember as a teacher years ago, one of the assignments I gave my students on a couple of occasions was to take a photograph and let's do a painting of it. But I said, I don't want to see any photographs of relatives, friends, loved ones. Nobody that you have any kind of an emotional attachment to. Because it's going to get in the way.
An unknown subject.
Did God have something to say about that? You go back to our history and you find cautionary statements about that problem. So then I did work from those kind of sources. A student of mine in the mid-60s. Did I mention that, finishing up with the John Ely painting, that was the first horse painting I did in 1966, I believe. And he was sitting astride his horse, kind of one leg cocked up over the pommel of the saddle. And I took the snapshot of him. Although at that time I didn't know anything about photography. I don't work a camera. I don't know how I got the shot, but I don't remember. I just plainly don't remember. But then I used a background behind it that I had taken from National Geographic. Old issues of National Geographic. Because I was into a kind of, I was sort of, playing around with the realist tendency, but making sure that there was enough art gimmicks going on in the picture so that it would be
creating your own composition,
not just a flat-out dumb illustration of or depiction of a photograph. So I invented this fantasy, and eventually was purchased by somebody in LA or something, and wound up at Sotheby's in London at auction. Somebody bought it over there. I don't know what happened to it after that. It was at that point that I said, well, enough of these chickens and sheep and cows and stuff. I said, there's something about the horse. I thought, this has some mileage potential. Immediately, I recognized that the horse has been with us since art has been with us. I mean, it goes, it's in ancient art. It's on the caves at Lascaux. But not in the 20th century. You don't see any serious equestrian imagery in the 20th century. Now, what could that produce if I followed, if I went through that door and followed that? I have no precedent there. Coupling my experience, my sense of contemporary painting, with a subject which is ancient by comparison. Where could that lead? It was a very exciting prospect.
Now, a horse is a pretty intense animal to paint to begin with their muscle structure and everything going on. So, and I've seen your paintings and they're fabulous. I mean, well, it's photorealism. It looks like a photo.
Well, people will, usually to my chagrin, they'll come into a show or something and say, my God, those paintings, I can't believe them. My God, the way you handle those veins in the legs, you know. Well.
every fine detail.
Yeah, but anybody looked at the grass the horse is standing on? You know, that's not that bad longer. Either. You know? I mean, the veins are just there. You know? It's like everything else is there. You know? But people will somehow, they're attracted to that particular thing.
And now, you said you take 4 months. You can take 4 months.
On average, I used to take a little less than that. Wow. But then I slowed down with age. I did.
And that's painting every day? And
pretty much every day.
Now, just something that comes to mind. When you're doing this type of painting, you use you don't use a lot of paint on the brush, do you?
Well, it won't hold too much. That's just a little number two
really
sable flat.
That tiny.
It's it's about maybe not even a quarter inch wide, and that's what you might call the workhorse of my tool.
No pun intended. Yeah.
Yeah.
Workhorse. Yeah.
And even if the painting's large or whether it's small, I still use the same size brush.
Wow. Now, do you start in any particular area of the painting?
And that has a very practical reason. I don't usually use a mall stick. I use it on occasion, but only erratically.
That's a steadying stick.
Yeah. Yep. Well, Richard Estes has I've seen a picture of his, of him painting in a studio, and he has kind of a framework, a wooden structure that he sets his painting into, where he sets it over the painting, and it's got bridges that run through. Bridges. He can rest his hand.
Is that right?
And he can go anywhere he wants in the painting, and you know. But I tend not to use the mall stick, and I just rest the heel of my hand right on the canvas. And so I start in the upper left-hand corner. And basically work my way down to the signature corner, which is the lower right.
Really? So like at an angle type of thing?
At an angle.
Wow.
And kind of working out from that as I go. With some deviations. Sometimes the strategy might call for having to complete a whole area that's kind of off the beaten path from that particular direction.
Mm-hmm.
But basically it tends to... The white canvas that's left over keeps getting smaller and smaller, but it keeps moving in the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
So
now, do you think this is just off subject just a little bit? Do you think this is a segment of art that is going to remain and stay strong?
Do you mean a lot of artists are going to?
Yeah, are there a lot of new artists coming up into doing photorealism at this point?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it's already universal. It has been for some years now. People that. Commercial artists have used, they have a photo file that they've used, but that's for commercial art, and it's okay for them to do that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what the critics got so pissed about was that here were purportedly serious fine artists, in quotes.
Mm-hmm.
Using photographs.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, then the dirty secret came out that a whole host of 19th century artists, especially after the invention in the 1830s, could actually print a photo image on a surface, a piece of paper or a piece of tin or something, everybody was using this. They were somewhat circumspect about it because there were things in the air, of course, that didn't make it terribly popular even then.
Well, where
you had the emergence of 20th century abstraction and high concern for formal issues in painting. Aikens considered the father of American realism, and yet his work is replete with photographic references. He had no problem with that.
Well, if you go back earlier, we were talking before this interview about the camera obscura and all the all the way back for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah,
I'm using some type of imagery through light and magnification.
This prejudice against the camera is a very recent thing, of course. Mm-hmm. Of course, the camera's a very recent thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's interesting how the threat of I think there's a good deal of fear about the role of the artist as a shaman, as a magician, a miracle worker somehow, becomes threatened by modern technology. Mm-hmm. And they want to keep it at bay so that that area that the artist has always operated in, that sets him apart from everyone else, can remain sacrosanct.
Well, if you think about Impressionism, began because of the camera. The people that were painting portraits had to deviate from what the camera could do. So that's, you know, the birth of Impressionism was all about photography, you know, and doing something different.
And not necessarily, I mean, the fact that there wasn't a color film in those days, it was all black and white, then one could go ahead and then tint black and white in some pale sort of way, but pointillism and that the late manifestations of Impressionism were just generated by an interest in all things optical and scientific. I mean, the art world was I mean, the interest in modern technology was picking up. It has, and at the time, it's just like global warming. It's just at a certain point in history, it's just started going up and an ever-steepening curve.
So, about a year ago, I did, remember what you helped me with that auction at Pixar?
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of that animation artwork is partly computer-generated and partly painted together. So it's like mixed media of computer-generated art. And so that's like the next generation of what there might be controversy about.
Yeah. And that's already eclipsed my understanding of it entirely. Of course, I'm a total computer illiterate.
I saw a computer. I see a computer over
there. Yeah, that's my wife. She's smarter than I am. but when I look back at what we were doing in the late 60s, roughly, it's pretty primitive stuff compared to what they're doing nowadays in terms of whether they're sort of mixing and matching all kinds of stuff now. And it's one of the casualties of it, though, that I've kind of lamented of that onward and upward direction and mixing technology with tradition is that people don't seem to, in the first place, they don't recognize the difference, and now, and even if they recognize, they don't care anymore.
You mean about the purchasing?
Well, about what an image is made from, how an image comes about. We just sort of see images,
right?
And the fact that this is a handmade etching. Or this is computer-generated, pixelated contrivance. Doesn't seem to matter, even in the market.
Well, it has to do with everything across the board, I say. I mean, people don't really particularly care for, look, this beautiful pine corner cupboard you have right here. People don't really care if they're buying furniture that's made out of fiberboard, you know. Or, you know, it's kind of like, if it looks okay, it looks okay. And, you know, not question it, just buy it. That's why people will buy a print and put it on the wall instead of a painting.
Yeah.
And they can pay more for the frame of the print than the painting would have cost, you know. So,
It doesn't seem to matter that much anymore.
But it'll always come back to that. I think it'll always come back to You know, I think we've ran quite, I think we're over an hour, or close to an hour.
Oh, really?
I know we could go a long way here on this.
It's like I say, the guy from the Smithsonian. I talked to him for a solid 5 hours.
He asked you one question, right?
I promise to answer it in less than an hour.
Well, this has been great. I think we're going to have to wrap it up, though. So this has been a great interview.
Yes, thank you so much.
With Richard McLean. And my name is Martin Willis, of course, and this is
Phyllis Gall.
And we're going to sign
off. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Rich. Mm-hmm.